Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, President Trump is interested in criminal justice reform. What will make a difference? In a White House whose messaging on legislative issues is often sporadic and inconsistent, President Trump has repeatedly returned to the idea of prison rehabilitation and sentencing reform. He mentioned it in his State of the Union speech. He held a roundtable in January on the issue.
Two-thirds of the 650,000 people released from prison each year are arrested again within 3 years.
And the topic came up again in early August when he met with black pastors from urban churches. Here's Pastor John Ponder from Las Vegas talking about hiring people who have been released.
One of the things that we've learned was that employers are not willing to hire people. They're not willing to hire projects. And because of the existing initiatives, when we're able to help them to be tremendous assets to the employers and not liabilities, then they're hiring them all day long.
So what's on the table? What kind of a difference will it make? And as our guests join us, your perspective is important, too. If you or someone in your family has spent time in jail or prison, what do you think is the top priority for prison reform? And if you work on these issues, what do you think is stopping meaningful prison reform from happening? So your own experience, someone in your family, you yourself have spent time in the correction system. What would you prioritize as the top reform? And if you work in this field, you work on these issues, what do you think is stopping meaningful prison reform from happening? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve is with us. She's Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Delaware, and she joins us today from Philly. And Nicole, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Holly Harris is going to join us a little later. She's Executive Director of the Justice Action Network. Nicole, I think we should acknowledge that some sentencing reform already happened during the Obama administration. What kind of a difference has it made, and are those reforms still being put into place?
You know, I think the sentencing reforms that happened in the Obama era in some ways acknowledged that we were too tough on crime, right? That was a politically, advantageous position for politicians to have. So even if you go back to the Clintons, they were creating terms, very racialized terms like super predator, mm-hmm. to in some ways define a supposedly urban criminal that was wreaking havoc in our cities. And it led to really, really draconian sentences for drugs and even other nonviolent offenses. And it ballooned the prison population to what we now kind of, you know, talk about as mass incarceration. You know, so since the 80s, the federal prison population, you know, increased 600%. We did see some decreases in the prison population because of the, you know, the basically prosecutors, you know, holding back and saying, you know, maybe this isn't the right approach.
Yeah,
to crime prevention.
I saw a number. Correct me if this is not right. Federal prison populations fell for the first time in 40 years during the
yes.
last administration. Is that right?
Yes,
okay.
It actually did. We actually did see some headway. And, you know, what you saw is about a year ago, Jeff Sessions, you know, in some ways talking to his prosecuting army, if you will, and saying, you know, stop these reforms, put the brakes. Let's go back to our tough on crime policies. He's asking, you know, prosecutors to use their discretion to absolutely follow the law and not, you know, undercharge, et cetera. And really, there's no justifiable data that would support that this is a, you know, a positive strategy for being safe in America.
You're saying the rewinding of the reform, some of the reforms that were happening during the Obama administration.
Exactly. Okay. And so, you know, if we finally saw this, you know, the federal prison population declining, we're talking about a savings of money, but more importantly, a savings of humanity, where we're incarcerating less people or we're, incarcerating for them for less lengths of time. And that helps everyone. That helps families, communities, the prospects of a father, for instance, working and supporting his family. It is a savings, a human savings as well to everyone.
Holly, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I noticed that as some of these reforms took place during the Obama administration, there were states that are not necessarily known for their liberal criminal justice laws following suit. I mean, we had relaxed mandatory minimums laws in states like Oklahoma and Georgia and Mississippi and South Carolina. You're in Kentucky. Did your state make some adjustments?
Oh, absolutely. Over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, under a very conservative governor, Kentucky has made great strides. We now have a felony expungement policy in Kentucky that passed several years ago. We passed prison reform in Senate Bill 120 that allows for more job training, removes a lot of obstacles to successful reentry for individuals who are incarcerated. And then this past year, Kentucky became the very first state in the country to pass what we call a dignity bill, which improves conditions for incarcerated women, removes any sort of ability for individuals to be shackled, particularly during pregnancy. So, you know, we've made great strides here, and it's very interesting because, you know, Kentucky is, of course, Leader Mitch McConnell's backyard.
Right. Let me grab a call here from Jeremy in Anoka. Hi, Jeremy. It sounds like you have had some experience with the correction system, yes?
Yes, I have, from the mid-90s all the way to, the 2010, so almost 15 years straight.
What did you observe, and how does that influence your ideas about what really needs to be changed in the system?
Well, I did most of my time, it was all state time. It was in Colorado, and then some in Texas and some in Minnesota. I did a good portion of it in private prisons, and I was also in a maximum security for 2 years, so I ran the gamut. I was all over the place. What I observed, the main thing, if I were to look at a root, like kind of an esoteric approach, it started with there was sort of a desperation that a lot of guys felt when they were in their teens and into their 20s. And I think it stemmed from a lot of them just didn't finish school. Mm-hmm. And then I would say maybe 70 or 80% of them had, I mean, how do I say it? Like, not very cohesive family units. I mean, so there was that. Now, the family, I don't know how you work on changing a family, but I think the education thing is a really good start. I think that getting through high school is a huge obstacle for some people. Mm-hmm. And what happens is a lot of guys, they just felt desperate, and then they made a couple bad choices, and then it led to prison. And then after that, they got out, and they didn't see any more hope. So they went back to the only thing they knew.
Yeah, Jeremy,
let me
say this, though. I'm really glad you brought up education, because I know in some states the money that was being invested into education programs has been inconsistent. Nicole, can you come in on this? What do we know about investment in education in correction systems?
Well, you know, it's more politically advantageous to continue investing in prisons, or has been in recent history. So federal prison spending climbed about 600% while the federal prison population increased about the same amount. I think what people don't think about is that, you know, Jeff Sessions talks about being tough on crime. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really want to be tough on crime, you have to start very early and provide the social services and support that allows people never to enter the system to begin with. And part of that is education. A part of that is keeping families intact. So one, you know, as a criminologist, one can think about if you incarcerate someone's father, You are taking out a breadwinner. You are taking out a stabilizing support system for the child. And are you in some ways creating the next generation of people that might offend or turn to drugs, right? So in some ways, we can think about not just education, but prisons in some ways acting as these proxies for social problems that we are not investing in, right? We're not investing in fixing education. We're not investing in, you know, rehabilitation for people who are on drugs, mental health. If we invested in those things instead of that federal prison spending, would we be in a better place? And, you know, in this new legislation is in some way saying perhaps we should start thinking of it. I think it's in some ways it's too late.
You're saying,
I mean, we're
first,
trying a back end reform.
Yeah,
you know?
The first so step program, right, legislation exactly. that President Trump supports. Before we get off on the education thing here, Holly, just to be clear for listeners, Congress is, and what the president is talking about would affect the federal prison system. But as I suggested, individual states are the ones, for the most part, funding their correction systems. And it has
That's
been
right.
quite inconsistent on what they're, what taxpayers are willing to pay for, right? Including education programs.
You know, one thing I will push back on, though, is the notion that somehow it's politically advantageous for, you know, legislators or members of Congress to invest in more prisons. In fact, we have polled, my organization has polled in more than, you know, a dozen states across the country, and we just got a poll back in Kentucky, and it showed that, you know, voters are actually very educated on mm-hmm. reform issues, mm-hmm. and, you know, 70-80%, depending on the question, of voters support more education, more job training for individuals who are currently incarcerated, and 70-80% support sentencing reform. So they support, you know, pulling back on a lot of these mandatory minimum sentences that have resulted, you know, in egregious injustices to a lot of individuals, you know, convicted of low-level nonviolent crimes.
Holly Harris with us from the Justice Action Network and Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve with us from the University of Delaware as we talk about prison reform. President Trump is interested in this, has mentioned it in his State of the Union, has convened some roundtables on it, just talked about it with a group of people early in August at the White House. We're asking our guests this morning and you, what should really be prioritized when it comes to criminal justice reform? What has already been done? We've talked a little bit about how some of these mandatory minimums have changed, although Jeff Sessions has sent out a kind of a different message from this administration. But what else really needs to be done? And what are we seeing when it comes to the effects of reducing these mandatory minimums? So if you or someone in your family has spent some time in jail or prison, where does the top priority come in for you? And if you work on these issues, what do you think is stopping meaningful prison reform from actually occurring, given what we've just heard about how average Americans feel about this? 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the region, 651-227-6000. And if you're on Twitter, it's a good way to reach me, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R, to John in Minneapolis. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for waiting. You have spent some time working in the correction system, is that right?
Yes, so I worked as a juvenile sex offender supervisor, you could say, like, of juvenile sex offenders at a licensed treatment facility in Hennepin County.
Uh-huh.
And I also have a background working for the BCA Predatory Registration Unit.
Yeah.
Also did my internship for my degree in corrections at Mankato. I did my internship at Dakota County Juvenile Probation with a juvenile sex offender agent. So
uh-huh.
The reform that I could see would really is desperately needed. Actually, it was attemptedly kind of brought up by Patty Wetterling in Minnesota, but she saw a huge disparity between the actual need for registering a juvenile sex offender and whether or not that's actually protecting that community for a lifetime registration, let's say, for a juvenile sex offender, which I've seen many times. Does that actually protect us?
Mm-hmm.
No. And is that is that punishing that individual more than one time? Are they actually being brought back into society in a normal fashion and they can continue a normal life? No, they have to continually register each new address, each time they are close to a school or a playground. They have to make sure that it's okay with that community. Can I move in here? Is this okay? And so it doesn't match up with what is actually reforming that individual to come back and reintegrate into society.
John, I'm really glad you brought this up because, as you and I know, this is really controversial and a subject of debate at the state legislature, this issue of civil commitments. But Holly, to what he's saying in general about these registration requirements and the civil commitment issue, is there room for reform in the way that we treat some sex offenders?
You know, of course there's room for reform. And look, it's a difficult issue with sex offenders and individuals who are convicted of violent crimes, although, you know, we can talk about the definition of violent in a bit. But, you know, he's absolutely right that, you know, think about it. It's really common sense. If you rob a person of the ability to get a job, to, you know, improve their education, to get adequate housing, what is that person going to do? You know, they're not going to be able to successfully, you know, reenter society when they leave incarceration. And more than likely, they're going to return to crime and return to prison. So, you know, the question then becomes for those who, you know, push back against reform, what actually does make us safer? What makes us safer is these, you know, individuals who are leaving incarceration finding a job, you know, having a stable income, the ability to support themselves and their families. That's what will enable these individuals to turn away from crime. So, you know, he's absolutely right about, you know, these reform efforts. They actually make us safer. And so for those who say that, you know, reform is really soft on crime, it is, in fact, tough on crime because the states that have implemented these reforms have proven to lower crime rates and lower recidivism rates, you know, almost across the board. So, you know, if you're looking for what makes you safer, you know, reform policies are really where that's at.
Nicole, I know you know this, that in states like Minnesota and others that use that civil commitment process, there's a big question about the constitutionality of that, right? Whether you can just commit somebody for the rest of their lives. What do we do you have some sense about how other states are dealing with this?
Well, I think, you know, I think just to go back to the reform that's on the table about this idea of three strikes and giving judicial discretion back, you know, three strikes took it away from judges. But you can imagine scenarios where there is a child sex offender, and that sounds like an extremely violent situation. But in some cases, those situations could be a 19-year-old having some kind of interaction, sexual interaction with a 16-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. And they didn't know the ages, et cetera. The judge may not have discretion to see the individual circumstances of those cases, and then that mark stays with that person forever. So, for instance, you know, they try to get hired. They're now in their 30s, and it appears as though they had, when you do the background check, as though they had sex with someone 16 years old, even though that crime occurred so long ago.
I see.
You're really excluding them from almost every aspect of social life. Imagine them now as a parent. They can't go to parks with their children. And so it really marks them in a ways that, you know, it is truly the scarlet letter. And if you were to give the judges back some discretion, they can make some better judgments. And that, you know, may be, I think, one of the hearts of where reform must lie, is that the discretion and the circumstances of individuals needs to be considered.
Nicole, I want to mention this First Step bill that passed the House earlier this spring. And this is something that the Trump administration supports. It's focused on mandatory minimums. And I was curious about what it does that the Obama administration reforms did not do. Is there anything new here?
You know, I think this idea of, you know, to me that this seems to be the precarious part of it, right, is that, you know, people in some ways are saying, well, you know, the back end reforms, the part one, if you will, the second chance reforms seem okay, but people are more reluctant to support the the, you know, easing the prison population, restoring mm-hmm. discretion and those types of things. And so I think if we were to go back, right, and not reverse, I think that's a first step. Like, rather than, you know, you had asked again about the federal prison population, it hit an all-time low in 2015, and that's a really good thing for everyone. I think the idea is that we have to continue using that discretion. You know, the most powerful actor in the criminal justice system in some ways is the prosecutor. It is Jeff Sessions. He can create marching orders that allow his, you know, his prosecutors to act in a particular way. And, you know, many of these mandatory minimums were meant for the kingpins. They were meant for the drug kingpins. They weren't meant for people with small amounts of drugs. So, for instance, if you had one prior drug felony and you're charged with, say, 10 grams of LSD, you could face 20 years to life. And with two priors, no matter how long ago they occurred, the penalty is life without parole. And judges had absolutely no authority to in some ways, you know, say that,
right?
This is not fair. Right. Yeah. And we know that when people are trying to rehabilitate after drugs, that relapse is actually part of the rehabilitation. Right. You don't get clean, if you will, without having a few relapses. This type of drug sentencing is so severe. It doesn't count for how people get off of drugs and heal and rehabilitate. And I think if we can move more to a model that mimics how people actually get sober, if you will, then we can start to make true headway. It sounds like we can't put the reforms in Jeff Sessions' hands. So I think the answer would be, yes, we need the changes in the law, and we need to go farther, because you have an attorney general who's not willing to exercise that discretion in favor of continued progress with decreasing the prison population.
Call here from Ellen in Lake City, Minnesota. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Well, I do intensive supervised release for the state of Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And when I do pre-release classes, when I pull the guys, they often have a lot of trauma in the background. They have recent deaths that they don't have the ability to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a Band-Aid to say that just jobs would help or just education would help, because I think we need to get to the bottom of where criminal behavior comes from. And there's a few issues there. There's separation of families. There's almost a culture of fathers going to prison, sons going to prison, that it's almost been normalized. And I think we need to get to the bottom of trauma, living in poor neighborhoods.
Well, Ellen, let me ask you this. I mean, this is important, and I've actually discussed this with a woman who wrote a memoir about being in prison, and one of her big messages is this is trauma that begins as a very young child and continues right through the experience in the correction system. But how do you, I mean, is that the kind of, I don't know, is it counseling? Is it the kind of rehabilitation that happens in prison? I mean, as we noted, there's some states that barely fund, you know, GED programs for people who are incarcerated.
Agreed. And it's a tough sell to say we need to have trauma therapy in prisons. But the reality is, if we want people to be safer out in the community, we need to help them put away the things that cause them to react instead of respond.
Okay.
And
I'm glad for the call, Ellen. Thanks very much. Here's Mark and Philip, who are both saying on Twitter, private prisons. What could go wrong when the arresting officer, the prosecutor, or even the judge may also be a shareholder and profits from crazy long sentencing and full jails? Phillips says, prison reform, is there any effort to end privatized prisons? So, Holly, can you talk to us about the effect that privatized prisons have had on this?
I'm so glad that this topic has been brought up, because I want to be very clear that you cannot be for criminal justice reform and also be in favor of private prisons.
Why not?
I was really, private prisons profit off of individuals, coming into their prisons. They want to fill up their beds. In fact, many of the contracts that the private prisons, and we got to stop calling them private prisons. They're not private. They're for profit. They are 100% supported by taxpayer dollars. So these are for-profit prisons. And very often their contracts, which are often not subject to legislative review and legislative oversight, demand full occupancy of their facilities. Hmm. And so, and the private prisons, their for-profit prisons, rather, are very smart. They're very politically active and engaged. They give very often through dark money vehicles considerable money to candidates. And they operate very surreptitiously. And so, I was very proud of Kentucky this last legislative session. They pushed back against an effort to reopen for-profit prisons. They had a terrible history in the Commonwealth. There was a rash of rapes that were covered up by the for-profit prison facilities years and years ago. And so these facilities, thank God, shut down. But we've got to remain vigilant. And I think one of the most dangerous things that Jeff Sessions has done is really sort of reopen this conversation about the need for for-profit prisons. They don't save money. And in fact, they cost taxpayers more money when these terrible incidents happen. And then there are, of course, the lawsuits that result. So again, I was very proud of Kentucky for pushing back on that last legislative session.
Nicole, are you as concerned mm-hmm. about the impact of privatized prisons?
Absolutely. I think anytime you have economic incentives to, incarcerate people, take away their freedoms and liberties, and in some cases, these for-profit prisons, when they put people into certain types of punishments, these are not under any type of judicial oversight. And that is what is extremely frightening. I think the idea that they supposedly save money, et cetera, I mean, to me, those arguments seem very hypocritical. I spent years in Chicago doing research in between 2011 and 2016, the city of Chicago spent $280 million on police misconduct cases. Think about that money, what we could do with it. $280 million. How could we reform our education systems? How can we get the trauma counseling that the caller just asked for into our jails and prisons and help people not come back by giving them, not just medicating them, that's a Band-Aid, but actually getting to the heart of why they lashed out violently or why they're taking drugs to, in some ways, medicate a trauma. I mean, to me, the for-profit industry is seems to be the most insidious thing, is that you can in some ways profit by people's impoverishment, by people's addictions, by people's failures, and rather than rehabilitate them and make them whole and try to get them back into society, in some ways we're giving up on them and we're saying, you know what, it's an insult to injury. Now we're going to in some ways have an organization, a corporation make a profit off of you. To me, that's the worst type of ethics.
Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve with us from the University of Delaware, where she's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice, and Holly Harris is the executive director of the Justice Action Network, joining us from Kentucky. Conversation here about criminal justice reform. It is something that President Trump is interested in. It's something that the Obama administration pushed through. What remains yet to be done? One of the things I want to talk about on the other side of news is parole reform. This is interesting. Georgia has been experimenting with parole reform. You know that Minnesota also passed Ban the Box. Are these the kinds of reforms after someone has served time that can also make a big difference? I'd like to hear from you if you work in the field, if you've spent some time in our correction system. 651-227-6000. What do you prioritize as most necessary, most urgent when it comes to criminal justice reform? 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. To Peter in Minneapolis. Hey, Peter, hi. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
That's okay. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Just before the break, you had talked about things that might be important to do after someone's done with their sentence, right. And that is a piece that I see a lot. I'm a medical case manager, and I work with people trying to get them into health care, and one of the biggest barriers they face is housing. And that's also true of employment, where not only do you need a job to be able to keep yourself out of trouble and live when you get out of prison, but you need a place to stay in order to have a job. And
right.
the the rental market's so tight out there for anybody. But then if you are a felon or if you have any sex offenses, there are very few openings out there for you. We do keep lists of felon-friendly housing, and they're considerably smaller than other options. And I think that, you know, we have to find some kind of housing or some sort of larger way of addressing the housing behind people who come out of prison, because frankly, prison is more stable than living on the street for a lot of people.
So Peter, what would make a difference? I mean, you know that we've talked about affordable housing a lot. Would it be what, in incentivizing developers to make some of their properties available to people with a criminal record?
Yeah. Because I know that one of the things that they're looking at is removing the to require landlords to accept Section 8, so they would disperse people who are on Section 8 rather than have them concentrated in a few buildings. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of solves the NIMBY reaction to public housing, to people who are on public assistance. And it would also be the same approach to people who are felons or sex offenders. Don't require concentration because of that, because a certain percentage of buildings across the board would have space dedicated for affordable housing units, some of it felon-friendly. Sometimes public housing can help with that. But just in general, I mean, this is one of those other side effects of the lack of affordable housing in general. And so that is an issue unto itself that heavily influences prison recidivism.
Really good to have your perspective, Peter. Thanks much. Glad you heard the show. Nicole and Holly, I wanted to talk to you about parole reform, because I was reading about what Georgia is doing. They're relaxing laws that send people back to prison if they violate their parole. And they found that the parole violation population dropped by 35%. I mean, that's a big number. Are other states, Nicole, to you first, are other states experimenting with parole reform? And is that a place that you think would make a difference?
You know, I can only I looked in the Chicago area at probation and parole, so I can speak to what Illinois is doing.
Okay.
Which is, they're thinking of looking at holistically once people to transition them, right? If we can keep people out of prison or jails in any way, shape, or form, it is always a better alternative. I think one of the key issues, though, is a cultural shift within the officers that manage parole and probation, which is there is this kind of gotcha mentality amongst the officers. So they feel accomplished, if you will, when they bust somebody for having, you know, a joint, if you will, or if they find somebody has been drinking. Those are these tiny violations that become, you know, that will send people back to prison or send people back to jail. And have we really succeeded, right? To me, success is to keep them out and to continue reintegrating them. So I think, you know, probation and parole, when we have these reforms, they definitely have to come with the support systems, for instance, like housing security, halfway houses, drug treatment, ways to transition, and ways to have people safely fail in small ways, but not have that gotcha mode. And that is a mentality that has to, I believe, change, right? We have to train these officers to think this way, that they are assets to rehabilitation, and they're not an extension of the police kind of gotcha system. So that to me is one of the biggest reforms that we need within those reforms, right? With if we have a movement to change parole and make it less punitive, the buy-in from those on the ground needs to be there as well.
Holly, I'm going to grab a call here. Listen to what Damon in St. Paul has to say about this. Hi, Damon. Glad you called.
How you doing?
Thank you. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I guess she just touched on what I wanted to talk about.
Good.
And it's really that cultural shift around probation violations and parole violations. In Ramsey County, they had the highest probation violation, in the whole state. So they're sending people back for being 10 minutes late, for missing phone calls, for not being able to find a job. So those are the kind of things that send you back to prison. And they are really in this kind of gotcha mode that your guest was just talking about. And this is what's increasing the populations in Minnesota. So the prison is really not overcrowded. So they've been talking about we're getting to this overcrowded state, but we're not overcrowded. The reason that there's overcrowding is because of all of these folks that are being sent back to prison on probation and parole violations. And it's really excessive. And they're not really supporting the folks with things that they need. So you think about a person who's been in jail for 10 years,
right,
and you give him 30 days to get a job, and he can't get a job in 30 days, and you send him back to prison.
Yeah. Damon, so, it sounds like you're involved with this part of the system. Is that right?
Yes, I'm with an organization called Inequality,
mm-hmm.
and we're doing a lot around probation and parole violation, and we've been working a lot in juvenile. So there are some change in mindsets around juvenile probation and the juvenile correctional facility. So people want to, you know, reach in and try to do what they can to help kids, but they forget about all the young people who have gone through the juvenile system and that are now in the adult system,
right,
that need help also.
Yeah, really good to have your call. Holly, what would you say to that?
Well, you know, you mentioned the states that we're going to be targeting for parole reform and probation reform, and one of them is certainly Minnesota. And your caller makes an excellent point. You know, there are a lot of demands of individuals who are on parole. Very often they have to meet once a week with their parole officer. They have to do programming, which, quite frankly, many of them may not actually need. And so that starts to jeopardize their job, jeopardize their ability to care for their families. And then, of course, if you lose your job, that jeopardizes your parole status. So, you know, the one size fits all policies don't work. You know, these plans really need to be, you know, tailored to each individual. And they have to ensure that you're not going to interfere with that individual's ability to live and care for their families.
Call here from Carl in New Ulm. Hey, Carl. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your experience with this?
Well, I'm calling as an employer, and I'm hearing a lot of stories about people that just are not given a chance. 10 years ago, I interviewed a woman who had been convicted of a sex crime. She was, I think, 20 or 21 and had an affair with a 17-year-old boy. She came into my office. She was honest. She says, I'm a registered sex offender. I hired her. And then realized the nightmare when I tried to get insurance when they wouldn't allow me to bond her to work in the office. So I said, well, I'll cover her if there's ever a mistake or anything like that. And I think if employers will look at the big picture and realize, as some of your speakers have said, people commit crimes early in life and they, you know, some of these things haunt them forever. Well, I was very happy to offer a job. She worked for me for 15 years. And retired, and I had a very positive experience. But the thing was honesty, is that she came to me, you know, up front and told me about her past.
You know, I really understand the impulse to want to hide that information from most employers, Carl, because I'm not sure everyone would have, it would have been very easy just to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't afford this.
Yes.
But you kind of show that there's the other side to that, too, taking a risk.
It takes a special employer. I mean, I had a small office, 15 people, 16 people. For me, it was easier. I know for a big corporation, some of them can't afford to take a chance, but I think we should. I think, you know, this is a society that encourages second chances, and I had nothing but positive things to say about this employee.
I'm glad you heard the show. You also bring up something that I wanted to ask Nicole about. Nicole, Minnesota has the ban the box legislation that allows people with a criminal record to not disclose it on an initial application. I'm curious about whether you know how far that's spread in the country.
Yeah.
And I also want to add here that the law does not, I mean, at some point the applicant is going to have to disclose it. So you might get through the door, but there are still plenty of opportunities for employers to close you out if they see a criminal record. Go ahead. What'd you can say?
Exactly. You know, we had a movement here in Pennsylvania that, you know, a political movement, people lobbying to have a similar reform, a ban the box reform. And, you know, really it gives people, you know, just a second chance. So the caller really articulated well, right? So your application it falls on the desk and you want to work in retail, you want to work in hotel industry, and as soon as you check a box that says have you been incarcerated, check the box, you're already done.
Mm-hmm.
There is no sense of getting a chance to in some ways make a case for yourself. I think this in some ways gives you a chance, right? Is that you can get that resume on the desk, you can get that job, but it does take it takes, you know, empathetic employers like the caller to really, you know, take those chances on people. And I think that's, you know, in some ways that's what's lacking, is that look at the barriers that that employer faced. So even when he wanted to give a person a second chance, he had to actually, you know, double down on his gamble, if you will, right? That's how the system is looking at it. So it's certainly a step in the right direction, and states are following suit, and people are more aware that people deserve those second chances. But it is still pervasive, right? And so you did see some employers, instead of saying, have you been convicted of a felony, have you ever been charged, right? Then that's another way of asking people who have been charged. That's truly unfair, right? Because charged does not mean convicted. Right. And a lot of people of color have been charged, and they've had the charges dropped or been found innocent. So again, you know, the hope is to level the playing field as much as possible. And the more we do, the more we encourage people to get legitimate jobs that are not forcing them back into dealing drugs on the street or doing something to make ends meet, the more we're helping with that recidivism rate. We're just not doing it in a punitive way. We're not doing it in a harsher sentence way. We're doing it in a way that provides people with stability and support.
To Jim in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hey, Jim. Hi.
Yes. Yes.
Glad you called in. You are a probation officer, is that right?
I was.
What did you think of what you heard us saying about probation and parole reform?
I can only speak for probation, and I don't believe what she says. I don't know where she gets her statistics.
As in, and specifically to what?
We are gotcha people. We want to catch them and put them back in the system. I've done that for 35 years, and all the people I worked with, I don't remember anybody having that kind of mentality towards a probationer.
Jim, did you have situations where there was a violation of, I don't know, a kind of a low-level violation or a technicality, and you, you know, were in a situation where you had to decide? I mean, perhaps the law said they were to go back to prison. How'd you handle it?
Not necessarily the law would say that. That'd be up to the sentencing judge.
Okay.
And there are a lot of other things you can do before you have to send them to prison.
Mm-hmm. And what are those things?
You can use jail time, counseling, treatment, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's that probation reform is necessary?
I don't think so. I've been out of it for 10 years, but when I left, I think it was working fine.
Holly, what would you say to this? And Jim, thanks for the call.
Yeah, and I would say every state is different, and you know, certainly I do want to address his point about probation officers, and they are some of the hardest working people in our system, in addition to, you know, those who run prisons and jails. And this is, you know, certainly not an indictment of them. What we very often say, it's not law enforcement, it's the laws that really need to change. And so, you know, there is a policy that we work on in many states called Swift and Sure Sanctions. The other side of the probation and reform, or probation and parole reform conversation, is there are those individuals who repeatedly, you know, violate the terms of their probation, and it lingers and it goes on and on and on, and then eventually they're revoked. And so there's a policy called Swift and Sure Sanctions, where these individuals immediately face sanctions, and they're not harsh. It's what the caller was talking about. You know, it's more of your counseling. You know, there might be very limited jail time, spending a weekend in jail, but it's where the probationer, you know, faces immediate consequences for violations, so it doesn't get out of hand and that individual is not eventually revoked. So, you know, again, it's not a one size fits all. Every state has different needs. But Swift and Sure Sanctions, I think, you know, would address some of the issues that the caller raised. The other point I wanted to make, and this goes back to the employers, you know, who are willing to hire individuals with records. I want to give you all a shocking statistic. 1 in 3 American adults has a criminal record right now.
Wow.
One in three.
Wow.
So if you are an employer who is not willing to consider an individual with a record, think of the skilled workforce,
the talent
you're missing out on. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, we're not talking about an obscure minority here. Every single American family has now been impacted by our broken justice system. I'm really, really grateful for those employers that, you know, are willing to take a risk. I wouldn't even call it a risk, because I'd say without exception, every employer that we've worked with that hires individuals with records or who have served time say that, you know, these are their very best employees. They're the first to show up in the morning and the last to leave at night.
Holly, I really appreciate the time this morning and the insight and your experience. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Holly Harris, Executive Director of the Justice Action Network. Melissa says on Twitter, my brother spent some time in jail and prison, and mental health services are so limited. To really be better people, we need to address deeper issues. And to the phones to George in Detroit. Hi, George. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
I wanted to, I was going to say something else, but I wanted to reiterate about the probation.
Sure.
I get 17 years in federal prison, and I just got out about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you about my probation officer. She is part of my support group, and she does nothing but bend over backwards to try to help me and keep me, I guess
on the,
what you would say is
on track.
Keep me on track because, you know, it's tough for some, you know, especially somebody that's been gone 17 years and to come out and, you know, you have to learn all, you know, you have to learn about a smartphone. You have to learn about all these other things. But I wanted to iterate another thing about the prison system itself. Now, I don't have any state prison experience. All my experience was in the federal system.
Mm-hmm.
However, I want people out there to kind of understand that not all of the prison system is like this, but there are people in the prison system that work within the prison system that they want you to come back to prison because you are providing a sustaining their families. Now I'm not saying that they're jumping out there to try to, you know, make you come back.
Right.
But they're sure not going to help you. You have to be able to help yourself if you don't want to come back to prison. And that's really the bottom line of any sort of anything, you know, that if you are not willing to help yourself, you're not going to succeed in life.
Do you,
George, what I had to say.
Yeah, I just want to ask you a question. Do you feel like you will not see the inside of a prison again?
I will never go back to prison. No, but that's my choice. You know, I will never commit another crime. Even if I was in a desperate situation, I mean, I got in a couple situations where I was worried about my living situation when I got out. And, you know, my first thing I called my probation officer and I said, you might have to put me back in the halfway house. And she's like, well, let's see if we can work something out different before we put you back in the halfway house.
It's really good to hear that that your probation officer has been so helpful. It's good.
She has bent over backwards for me. And as a matter of fact, I have 5 years probation and I went in there in June. And right now I have filed to get off of probation completely with the courts. So I'm just waiting on the judge to sign it right now. And she, I'm telling you, she is my support group. And I have mixed emotions about getting off probation because she is such a support group for me.
I can hear this. I hear. Yes, it does. George, I'm really glad you heard the show. And Nicole, I've got about a minute and a half left, but just a reflection on what George has said about this.
You know, I think it's great. I mean, to me, remember I said it was about there's a culture reform, and you need enough probation officers like that Jem to be able to help people. I would disagree saying you can only do it with your own willpower, right? It takes a social support network. You see, it's not just him. It is the probation officer mobilizing resources and support. And if you watch, you know, my work, I studied lots of violation of probation cases. And you know, one probation officer called those defendants trash in the ocean, that it kept coming back to her.
Yeah.
And to me, that we need to get rid of that mentality. We need more probation officers that are willing to mobilize resources and services and see defendants as worthy of a life after incarceration. To me, that's key. We have to see them as human beings.
Nicole, thank you. Thanks so much for the time and the insight this morning. Good
Thank
to have you. Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve, Associate Professor at the University of Delaware in the Criminal Justice Department. Ross adds, I feel like the general public is very misinformed about prison costs and operations. People don't understand how much profit prisons cost the U.S. financially and ethically. How can we as a country clear the smoke over the issue so average Americans can truly understand?
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. to add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.